This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The shooting of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, has sparked not only protests and riots in cities across the country, but have initiated some tough conversations on diversity in the U.S. and brought them to the forefront. My guest today gives a lot of thought to race relations. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is the executive director of the Privilege Institute and founder of the White Privilege Conference, a national event that deals with issues of diversity and privilege. He spoke earlier this fall with students at Winona State University and UW-La Crosse. At UWL, one of his lectures had the provocative title of The N-Word, Is There a Message in the Madness? We talked about the polarizing connotations associated with the N-Word.
It's had a pretty strange and troublesome history, which is actually the title of a great book by Randall Robinson called Nigger, A Strange and Troublesome Word, and that I find every place I go. You have these kind of polarized dynamics in the university community, even the larger community surrounding the university, but you also have what I call a kind of new generation of people engaging this word and having very different feelings about this word. And that's really what I'm trying to do with this workshop and this session that I've designed. It's part educational to really talk about the history. It's part, you know, relationship to get people just even having some dialogue and conversation. But the number one thing I'm trying to do that I feel is unique about this workshop is really pushing people to think about the psychological impact of nigger, how this word in its history in our great nation still is so prevalent today, and I would argue still impacting the way people act and interact. And that's really where we have the meat of our discussion with our audience and really looking at if nigger in its ever-present existence in our society is having an impact on the way you act and interact day to day, every day.
For people who aren't familiar with the N-word, and I'm going to say the N-word because I'm not comfortable using it, can you tell them the history of the word and the deep, profound history and impact that it has, especially on the African-American culture?
Yeah. And that's really what people come to the workshop for, is kind of looking for where did this thing start? Like it was a piece of jewels or a diamond in the rough that was dug up somewhere on some planet and ta-da, here's the N-word. And it's not that. It's really not something that you can say this is exactly where it started, because it really ties to language, ties to culture, ties to the enslavement of Africans. And so many people have different perspectives about it. Kennedy writes about the etymology, the history coming in, some of the slave trade. What I really look at in the historical sense is how it became ever-present in American society, in the way that people interact with each other, in the way that it impacts the way people think about each other, particularly after Emancipation Proclamation. Because most people, and I would be one of those folks that say, nigger didn't really mean anything to especially black people when they were in slavery because they were property. But once I'm free and you call me that, I'm like, no, my name is Eddie. So really talking about after that time, how nigger really began to be a problem in the way people felt about how they should be responded to. And then also how it also, I would say, played a role in significant policy decisions, institutional design, systemic organization operations, in that when you and I came into the bank, I mean, you would receive a very different service or interaction. And also being a woman, of course, it'd be different. But me, in addition to being, you know, a man possibly, but also being a black man, I mean, I had no identity. I had no substance. So how nigger really describe groups of people, particularly African-American people in American society, is really what I look at historically. And then when you look at the specifics of it, I argue that nigger is traumatic. So my entire life, I grew up under this negative umbrella of what this word means, and it shapes and impacts the way I think I should be as a young man. And so when you see me as a PhD, shirt and tie kind of guy talking and interacting in a business formal kind of way, people are looking at me in my neighborhood saying, this guy's a sellout. I mean, he's not a real black man. He's acting white, right? Like the identity of who I really am is really challenged because nigger has shaped the way people think I should be. And so I argue, especially for a young black man, that that becomes traumatic. So there is some real specific kinds of conversations that I've been having about nigger, particularly with young black males and black people in general, that's different. But in a place like La Crosse or St. Peter, Minnesota, where I just came from, there are a lot of white kids in the audience. And I think that's another aspect of nigger that has gone unexplored. And what we're finding in the research around, especially hip-hop music, some popular culture stuff, which people would often agree plays a role in spreading nigger across our society, that the number one consumers of that are white kids. And no one's talking about what's the psychological impact of nigger on a 15, 18, 24-year-old white student.
Especially if the person may just be mindlessly singing along to a song.
That's right. That's right. Now, what I can tell you is it's traumatic for me when people are telling me at 5, at 10, at 15, at 20, what's up, my nigga? Like, greeting me in this way, shaping the way I think about myself. I'm telling you, that influenced the way I battled with what kind of man was I becoming. What was my identity? Like, nigger had a traumatic effect on me. And what I'm asking is, if it's having that kind of effect on me and other, I wouldn't be alone, I don't think, as a person of color, black man, dealing with this struggle, then what's happening to a white kid, a young white girl at 16, or a young white man at 24 at the college level who's consuming this sometimes? I mean, what would you think in one rap song? It could be 25 times or 125 times, and they play that song on repeat 10 times before they get to class in the morning. I mean, nigger consumed that many times, does that have an effect on a white person? This is a part of the conversation that I think is missing about nigger that I would think ties into this conversation about police and police engagement, or teacher and teacher education, where we see a great majority of white people encountering kids of color, particularly young black males, in very negative ways. And I'm saying maybe it has something to do with their nigger consumption. I'm not saying definitively it does. I'm just saying maybe this is a area or an angle in which we should be exploring this impact.
With its prevalence in, you know, certain songs, or maybe you see it used in comedy too, if you're hearing it over and over again, especially people in the younger generation, are they not hearing it in its historical contents? Have they become desensitized to the N-word?
Yeah, I think all of that is true. But what we know is if I hear swear words over and over and over in my household, I can become desensitized to those swear words. But the point is, will that impact the way I think, I act? So the conversation about being desensitized to the word is an important one, absolutely. It actually becomes normal. I mean, like, it's a part of the way you act and interact. But what I'm looking at is, does it become psychological? Does it shape behavior? And I think we see that swearing affects the way kids react and interact with each other if they come from those kinds of households. It's unhealthy. It shapes their behaviors in unhealthy ways. And I'm saying we should be looking at nigger in that very same way. That, yes, that issue of being desensitized is not a good thing. But I want to go even a little deeper and say, what if that kid becomes a banker, a lawyer, a teacher, a police officer? Will it shape the way they interact with me when they pull me over, or when I come into their classroom, or I come for a bank loan? Well, statistically, the research would show absolutely there are some disparities going on there. Some people say racism, you know, some of those kinds of things. And I'm saying I'm not unwilling to explore that. But I think maybe we should get a little deeper and find out maybe there's a source that's deeper. I push people to, in our presentation, to get deeper, because it is so amazing what people come into the workshop for and why they're there and what they're trying to get out of it. And I think part of it is this historical piece. Part of it is this desensitized pop culture, blame it on the rapper kind of argument. And I'm not unwilling, and we do grapple with some of that. But what I'm pushing and challenging people is psychology. psychology. I'll say this. This is this really cool exercise that I do in the workshop that asks people to clear their minds, close their eyes, and I shut down the lights, and I say to them, a nigger just walked through the door. So with your minds clear, your eyes closed, tell me what the picture is that comes to your head. And inevitably, consistently, across hundreds of presentations, that picture is black male. So what I'm saying is, some people spend their lifetime never saying this word. And I'm wondering, what is the reason? Because if you never say it, but you still have this picture, then we got to really be looking at where that's coming from, why that is. And I think that's the work that I'm trying to do with this presentation. And as early as high school, college age, because if we can get it to them sooner, they can hopefully begin to interrupt some of that.
You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. He is the executive director of the Privilege Institute and founder of the White Privilege Conference, a national event that deals with issues of diversity. He spoke earlier this fall at UW La Crosse. One of his lectures dealt with the psychology and history of the N-word. What about maybe a young African-American male or female that comes into one of your presentations and says, well, I want to take ownership of the word. I want to be able to use that word because it gives me power.
That's in the room. And, you know, I always respect and honor that voice. But my argument is this. My viewpoint is this. And talking to young kids of color about the word and that perspective, I believe you cannot take something designed to kill you and turn it into something that's good for you. I say it in this way. You can't take poison and turn it into Kool-Aid. And so I really believe that there are better ways in which we can refer to each other and say hello to each other, or better things from our history that we can take ownership than one of what I would argue is the most destructive terms and psychological frameworks that exist in our society, and try to make it positive. And so that's really what I challenge young people to think about, is instead of calling each other nigger for a week, try calling each other brother or sister or king or queen or friend, and just see if there's a different effect, just to try it out. But that's my argument. You can't take poison and turn it into Kool-Aid.
There's an interesting video on your website where you talk with a number of people, all different ages, a couple different races, and it's people talking about their own relationship and history with the N-word. And it was interesting because there's one young woman who talks about how she thinks that many people's feelings about the word comes from their own discomfort with the hip-hop community or young African-American males. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Yeah, I think there could be some real truth to that. I think that one of the newest things I've asked the particularly younger generation to be willing to consider is nigger is possibly birthed into your psychology. It's given to you in utero, like baby Einstein. Like we play music to kids in the womb, knowing that now it impacts them and they're learning while they're in the womb of the mom. So if someone is giving someone racist jokes or saying these kinds of things, I'm saying it may be possible that you're birthed into the world with a foundation ready to be raised around racism and fear and hate towards people of color. And so, I mean, I think I don't know what the answer is for nigga. I really don't. I am perplexed, as perplexed as anybody else, how this word continues to be so strong and so long in our society. But I do think it's time to be willing to consider some newer things, some newer solutions, some newer angles in reference to how we explore it. And that's some of what I'm doing and talking about with kids that, man, it's just really, I think, perplexing as to why people could have such deep-seated hate and bias towards groups of people, particularly in this case with nigger and young black males.
So it's interesting because you're really challenging people to think about their usage of the word and its historical context and whatnot. And given those challenges, do you ever see a day, or would you want to see a day when this word just does not exist in the English language?
I feel like I'll live a long and strong life, but not that long and strong. I think nigger is here to stay. What I'd like to see in the future and the days I look forward to is that when I tell you a nigger just walked through the door, you have no connection. There's no picture that exists for you. That it's not me that appears in your psychology. That's what I'm working towards, is really working to help all kids, white kids and kids of color, to understand that nigger is a creation in our society that's been injected into our psychology and is influencing the way we act and interact towards people. And that's the goal. That's what I'm working towards, so that we can begin to battle that, that when you hear nigger, when you are called nigger, there's nothing that connects to you. I mean, you're looking at, as I try to do, if someone calls me a nigger as I'm walking down the street, I'm looking at them as if they have an illness, like something's wrong with them. Like, how can you look at me and associate that word? And that's taken me a while to get to that point and interact with another person, mainly because I had to work on myself psychologically. I hear nigger 20 years ago. I'm ready to fight. I had a connection to it. And so that's the day I'm looking forward to, is nigger has no visual, no substantive concrete picture in the psychology of people.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr. He's executive director of the Privilege Institute, and he's also founder and program director of the White Privilege Conference, and was recently speaking at the campuses in UW-La Crosse and Winona State University about issues of diversity. I want to talk a bit about just some things that have really surfaced in the news lately. We look at the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. You know, an officer shot an unarmed African-American teenager, Michael Brown. You know, this really sparked up a number of protests and grabbed international headlines. Racial tensions between African Americans and police are nothing new. But why is it, do you think, that this incident, why now is it that people are really focused on this?
I wish I had an answer to that. I think for me, part of my reaction is frustration and concern. It just seems to be, at least in my mind, too frequent. And also it brings flashes back of Emmett Till and a historical time where you would think in a nation as great as ours, we've moved a lot farther along in reference to at least police and citizen engagement. And especially in places where, like St. Louis, there are signs of people of color. It's not like this is a totally isolated place where there's no opportunity to interact. So you would think that things would be a lot farther along for me. So that's, I'm not quite sure why such the flurry and fury at this time. But I know for me, part of it is connected to the fact that I'm pissed and fed up, because it seems like consistently the experience I'll have with police could cause me to die, even with my hands up. And so that's the way I'm feeling, and that's what my concern is as a father of two boys of color, one a senior in college, one, you know, 4 years old. I'm thinking, man, there may not be anything I can do, because even in the most passive position of surrender, you still can freaking die. So that's where I'm at. That's where I'm at. I'm just furious and concerned, because it seems like the pattern is consistent. I just, as a father, am worried.
What do you tell your sons?
You have to do some of the things that I think are important for all of us when our kids get in trouble, all that kind of stuff, you know, in particular getting pulled over by the police, you know, ways you interact with the officer, showing respect, you know, showing your hands, all that. So I think there's now tools out there that didn't exist even 10 years ago to help a father like me help his young son understand some of the to-dos. But what's really concerning is, again, in the case of Ferguson, it seems as if Mike Brown did all of that to be in the position of ultimate surrender. And I think that's where I have extreme concern, that there's a part of letting him go in society that leaves me extremely vulnerable, I feel, simply because he's a man of color. And so some of the other things I feel like can be done wherever I'm going to be living. I'm going to be trying to work with the police and police leadership and police officers, because I don't want my son to just have a negative feeling when he sees the police or the police officer in our neighborhood. And so trying to play a role in positive relationships being established between my son, myself, and the police is another thing. And also looking at and asking questions about training and bias and anti-bias and all of that. So I don't feel like I'm going to remain passive and mad. I'm going to remain active and mad, because I think for me, that's the strategy that's going to help me to sleep at night, when I know there are going to be times when my son is going to take the car or whatever, and we as parents will have no control over what happens to him when he's gone. And so I think that's the way I'm going to be trying to have myself be able to lay my head down and have the least worry possible.
Are there maybe communities that you feel like are doing that correctly?
Well, I sure hope so. It seems like when you watch the news, that's not a part of the storyline, which is unfortunate. It seems like what's often showed is the tension, the conflict. Not to say that we shouldn't be aware of some of that, but it is kind of disappointing when you watch time and time again, all that's shown is the conflict. I don't know specifically of any of those communities off the top of my head. I'm sure there's some out there, but I think you raise a very important point that I'm trying to be thinking about myself. And from my own personal experience, like, I can't remember being really ever feeling extremely positive about the police as a young black male. Like, that's problematic. And that's not the experience I want my sons to have. And so really trying to be, from the earliest ages, having them have positive experience. Again, being aware of what's going on the larger, you know, all that kind of stuff. But being really active and intentional about not allowing my sons to just be raised with venom towards police. And I think, and I hope I'm not alone, and I hope that there are not only folks of color, but also majority folks, police officers, parents, that will adopt this initiative. And maybe it could start in a place like La Crosse or St. Peter or Madison, but it's got to be, there's got to be an initiative that interrupts that cycle of venom and tension that I feel is consistent and persistent when it comes to people of color, particularly black folks and police.
We have there's an African-American male on the police force here who's sued the city and the police department over racial discrimination. He's filed a federal lawsuit. You know, and when you hear about that and you wonder if there is a police officer who doesn't feel comfortable around his own colleagues, what's going on within the community when those officers are interacting with African-American men and women who are not on the police force?
Yeah, and I think this is where leadership is critical. And I think that for me, if I was here, I would be really not trying to hide or push under the rug this situation, because that's real and that has to be dealt with. But what learning can take place? And I think, I mean, whether it's a ping pong tournament or Xbox tournament, I mean, like softball, football, I mean, there are so many ways, chess, checkers, I mean, Scrabble, I don't know. There's just so much stuff, so many opportunities to really start to, again, break down those walls. And I think that's where leadership has to be intentional. Whoever that person or persons are, say, for the next 10 years, this is not going to be the way that we operate. And here's our 10-year plan to interrupt that cycle of tension, that cycle of venom that exists between police and citizens in general, possibly, but specifically black folks and especially black males.
I wonder, too, you know, you look at a city like St. Louis, which has historically been pretty diverse, has its own strange, troubled history with racism. And then you have a city like La Crosse, where it's an old river town also. I think it was diverse for the area, you know, 100, 150 years ago. That diversity sort of weaned off, and now we are seeing more of a less white community, I guess you could say. So in those two parallels, when you look at cities like that, I mean, does it just come down to having those conversations, or do you have to really approach the way that we talk about race relations in different ways?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. I think you raise a very significant and important point, and that is America's changing. And again, this is outside of people who are fighting for legislation to stop folks or trying to build barriers to folks getting here. I mean, we are experiencing what they're calling the browning of America.
The minority majority.
Right. And so what it says to me is, are you ready? Are we ready? And that takes skills. I take the skills-based approach that as we see the changes that are happening across this nation, that it's going to be really important that we build the skills to have a positive and productive result. Because anytime you have integration without preparation, the results are never positive. We've seen this with Brown v. Board of Education, where you brought people in places where they didn't want to be, they weren't accepted and weren't welcome, and they're still reeling from some of those early integration initiatives in communities like Kansas, I mean, all across the nation, in fact. So I think that a place like La Crosse has an opportunity to be an example, a model, because the numbers aren't so daunting as they may be in other larger cities, and people here know each other. I mean, it's a community where families and names have been here forever. And I think those are the folks I would be looking for and hoping would be stepping forward to say, my family's been here hundreds of years, and we are noticing the changes, and we are freaking excited. So here's what we're doing as a family, as a business, as a community to really help this integration to be successful. Because we also know, actually, recently, Scientific American has just released an article about how diversity makes you smarter. So there's now research showing that there are real benefits from diversity. And if it's not about your intellects, we know, I mean, as far as commerce, as far as business, I mean, diversity is good business. And so I think there's a lot of positives for communities like this to really, for reasons, positive reasons for communities like this to get out in front and not be operating from conflict and incidents, but being proactive and being leaders in reference to these initiatives.
Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is the executive director of the Privilege Institute. We talked this fall during his visit with students at Winona State University and UW-La Crosse that dealt with diversity. Coming up, more with Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., including the concept of white privilege and his thoughts on what the first biracial president has meant for African Americans. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to Dr. Eddie Moore Jr.'s website. Our site also has other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. About 15 years ago, Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. helped start the first White Privilege Conference to gather people from across the country to have a serious talk about race and diversity in the U.S. Since that first conference in Iowa, it has grown and attracts thousands of people in different cities each year. Moore spoke about diversity issues this fall with students at UW-La Crosse and Winona State University. He stopped by our studios, and I asked him to talk about the concept of white privilege.
The nuts and bolts of it is because of white skins, you get a perk. You get a bonus. You get a reward simply because you have white skin. I argue that America was colonized by white people for white people. The systems, organizations, institutions that they developed really were intended for white-skinned people.
And you gave the example earlier. You and I may both enter a bank. There is a chance that I may have an easier time getting a loan than you will because I have white skin.
That's a perfect example. When you walk into the bank, just because of white skin, you receive a perk, right? Just like if we walk on the car lot, as a man, I receive a bonus. So the other thing that's important about the White Privilege Conference is we don't just look at skin-based privilege. We work and challenge people to look at privilege comprehensively. The fact that we're on the radio talking and listening to each other, not worried about if it's going to be closed caption when it's played, right? That's a real privilege. Mm-hmm. So we look at ability privilege as well. And so we really work hard to cover privilege comprehensively. But the starting point is really race-based, because the history of our nation is really built a lot on the foundation of whiteness. And the structures from banks to schools to universities, I mean, so on and so forth, was really built and benefited white males. And so it's important that as we expand into other kinds of privileges, that we understand the source. And so a lot of people, I mean, it's just amazing how people can't even get past the title. But those aren't the people that we're interested in having fights and battles with. We're really interested in having conversations with people who have done some diversity work and really ready beyond being a good person to look at closing gaps, gaps around economics, gaps around education, gaps around sexism, homophobia. Like, there are some real serious consequences and gaps that exist for people day to day, every day, around some of these identifiers that we've talked about. And that's what we're looking at the White Privilege Conference, is this concept of diversity, power, privilege, but also leadership. And so it's been really great to be at college campuses because, as I've said to college students, I mean, y'all in 25 years coming through this fine education like Gustavus and UWL and Winona State, I mean, in 25 years, when you make a phone call, people are going to return it. I mean, these educational institutions and going through this education give you opportunities, give you perks, give you privileges. And so having some understanding of that allows you, I think, to do and make better choices so that we live and are working towards a more equitable society.
And you probably can't understate the leadership aspect of it, because I did attend the White Privilege Conference in Madison last year. As you said, it was the 15th one. There were a number of UW La Crosse students that went too, and I met with a number of them afterwards just to have a conversation about people's takeaway from the event. And it does seem to empower these students. It really gets them thinking. It really gets their, you know, their brain spinning. You can just see the ideas, and in some cases wanting to take action on certain instances on campus.
Yeah. And again, it's been interesting to watch some of the resistance to folks bringing college students to the conference, because, you know, people spend so much money to do some of the strangest things for their kids, you know, and stretch them and challenge them, whether it's, you know, football camps. I've seen places where people are spending hundreds of dollars to send their kids to football camp or basketball camp. And again, I'm not opposed to any of that, because I think it helps to have folks with expertise work with your kids and help them grow and expand and all of that. But when it comes to diversity issues, it's like you expend a little money. And white privilege is a relatively affordable conference. We're not charging exorbitant amounts of money trying to get rich and get paid and all that stuff. We're really just trying to create a learning environment where kids, young people especially, future leaders, are being challenged around issues of diversity at the highest level. And I just wish folks would stop hating on the conference, so to speak, and attacking and degrading, demeaning, and organizations and institutions that support, like UWL students to go, and really do as you've done. Talk to the students, like, see what their experience is like, hear what it is they've been challenged by and what it is they're hearing, and see if it's helping them or allowing them to do anything differently around critical thinking, which I would hope is why their parents are sending them to college, is why they're sending them away from home after high school. Like, this is what you want the institutions that you leave them in to do for them, is to bring them home smarter, bring them home thinking more critically, bring them home thinking wider and broader. And so that's what we're really excited about and really happy about with the conference. It's no matter what resistance is saying, when folks like yourself show up and say to a student, what the heck did you get out of this conference? They're having some really positive things to say.
I'm interested in your thoughts on the pushback, because, you know, there are few people out there who said, you know, university money, city money shouldn't be going to a conference like that. But also it seems that there are some people that don't understand the concept of white privilege, which is fine. I mean, everyone's constantly learning, and I'm sure the definition's always changing in everyone's mind. But, I mean, do you have a want to reach out to those people and try to get through to them and understand where you're coming from?
Yeah, you know, I think I spent a good part of my early career, early years in my career, particularly around consulting, dealing with folks in resistance mode. And what I've learned, especially dealing with family, I mean, some of the greatest resistance I receive is from the people I love the most. That's a whole nother show we'll have to do at another time. But seriously, I think the thing I've learned is there are some pancakes you'll never flip over. And so I'm not really making myself, working myself up, getting myself in an unhealthy state of mind, unhealthy state of being anymore all the time. It's not that I'm not willing to engage folks, but I'd rather spend my time with a young person who's really interested in learning and growing and really assisting them in that way. It's not like I'm not up for a good fight every now and then, but I'm really seriously having to think about the amount of energy and how unhealthy, high blood pressure, all that stuff that goes into having these kinds of arguments and combative kinds of engagements with folks when they're not really interested in learning. They're not really interested in listening. You know, they just want to be in combat. I feel like we're almost conditioning our kids to think that it's better to be combative than it is to be cooperative. And so that's not the model I want to show and not the way I want to spend my time and energy. So I'm not unwilling to take on a challenge about the conference. If they're saying, hey, you're wasting taxpayers' money, I'm saying, well, help us understand how you feel, why you feel that way. Here's what the young people, what the university, what the city government's getting out of this conference, right? I mean, the price of the hotels are the lowest price ever in national, international conference history in many cases. The registration is very, very reasonable. So what are some other things that possibly folks are expending resources on? And are you looking comprehensively? Why is it just the conference you're looking at? Because people do conferences all the time at the higher ed level. And so I don't know if it's really about the expenditure than it is about some of what you said. People just disagree with the subject matter.
When you read about, you know, the concept of white privilege, and this isn't always just with your conference, but there's some people who think that it's an anti-white movement.
Yeah, I tell you, some people, if they don't meet me, they think I'm the grand poobah of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, like, it's really a shock to people to see, oh, my goodness, you're the guy who started the White Privilege Conference, right? So, yeah, they think that in addition to being an attacking, degrading, beating up on white people kind of initiative, it also may be a white power initiative. So there are a lot of mixed messages out there. That's why it helps when folks like yourself come. Right. And we want people to come experience the conference. Now, if you're coming to experience, to learn and engage, we're open for that. But if you're just coming to be, you know, trying to expose or paint the conference in a way that it's not, that, I mean, it's just not healthy for us and for the people that we're working with, because that's not the real intention of what we're trying to do. And I'm not spending my energy on those folks anymore, because what I've learned is there are more good people, particularly across the Midwest, who are really willing and ready, especially young people. I mean, they want high level of engagement around this subject matter, just like they do in athletics and music and theater. They want to be pushed, just like they do in calculus and social studies and other kinds of subject matter in the classroom. They want to be pushed. The same is true around the issue of diversity.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. He's executive director of the Privilege Institute, and he's also founder and the program director of the White Privilege Conference, and was recently in La Crosse and Winona to talk about diversity issues. A big part of your mission is educating students and children just about issues of diversity and whatnot. And, you know, I think about my own schooling growing up. Teachers teach you that it's probably in your best interest to accept all people, of regardless of your religion, the color of your skin, your nationality, and that hate is bad. Are schools doing enough to talk about diversity and, you know, anti-prejudice issues? Of course, it shouldn't all fall on the schools. It should be parents, too. you know, and issues of privilege. Are issues of privilege being taught in the school? And is it ever like an appropriate age to start really thinking about white privilege?
Yeah, yeah. I think schools personally can do more. I think partly because my experience in education all this time says that people have been doing stuff. It's not like we have bad teachers with bad hearts and bad intentions in schools. I mean, actually, we have the opposite of that. But many of them don't have the skills, haven't had the training to really deal with these issues. So they've approached it in the way you just talked about. They say, I'm a good person. You should be a good person. So let's hold hands and sing Kumbaya. I mean, that's great. But when you're dealing with a society that was, you know, shaped and framed around issues of sexism, homophobia, racism, that doesn't always interrupt those cycles. So that's why you need skills and understanding, not only so that you can be a good person, but that you can battle and challenge some of these cycles of behaviors and decisions and results that have been going on for hundreds of years in this great nation. And so I feel like working more with teachers in their pre-teacher areas is something that we're seeing more and more of. I think also now schools bring me in to actually work with teachers on site, and teachers are willing to learn about new books that they can read and new strategies that they can try, because what we're also seeing is the student population is changing. I mean, not only is it this issue of diversity, I mean, just the kids that they're going to be dealing with, the 21st century is changing. And so it's a great time, I think, educationally to be looking at and rebooting and reconsidering a lot, in addition to diversity, also just the way we work with multiracial kids, kids who come from adopted home, kids come from single parents, because a lot of times we just dump them all in there and say, hey, they all will learn 1 + 1 = 2, you know? And what we know now is kids learn differently in what their home situation. And so I think it's an exciting time in education. Now, this white privilege thing, when did you start? I think for me, with my son, I mean, I'm not saying white privilege right now as a kid of color, but I am teaching him how he's really fortunate and blessed. There are a lot of things that he gets to do that other people don't get to do, from the food he eats, from the toys he has. So really helping him to understand empathy and possessions and taking care of things and giving back and not just, you know, assuming that this comes easy. So it's a early start into the conversations about privilege, if you ask me, that I think can be offered to young people at a really young age, because we know this, they're resilient, they're really smart. I mean, often kids are dumbed down because parents and adults aren't ready for the conversation. They are ready. So it's really for us in our home, our skills sharpening and growing so that we can give it to him appropriately, but he's ready for the information.
So when you talk with your son, or when you're talking about this with anyone else, how is someone supposed to appropriately use their privilege? I know that's a huge question, but whether it's white privilege, male privilege, able-bodied privilege, what does one do with it, especially in a society where there is so much non-privilege?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, just a simple example back to if we go to the car lot, you and I step on the lot, and if we're there together as a couple, the guy or the person who's selling the salesperson says to me, hi, how can I help you, Mr. Moore? Right? Like, totally doesn't even see you there. I can check that up. Right. That's a small thing where I can say, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. I'm actually here without all the expertise. Ms. Moore is actually the one who knows cars. Right. So I can interrupt that. And again, that's just a kind of male, female car lot situation. But I think there are many times where I can take the privilege of being seen as a male and interrupt, whether it's watching a commercial, whether it's catcalling on campus, right? There are some ways that I can seriously step in. Sometimes people are talking about, I don't really know what to do, and actually it's pretty doggone simple, right? Sometimes it's just the little things that you can do around privilege, whether it's, you know, someone just slamming on the accessible button to go into the door when they don't need the accessible button, right? Why are you using it and possibly, you know, causing it to be not ready or not functioning for someone who really uses it. So that's something I can do with my able body privilege, you know, or watching closed captions is another thing. Right? Just being sensitive that there could be someone that can't always hear the TV, that kind of thing. So there are little things, I think, that I argue, that I push, that I challenge people to think about and not think about, well, how can I make sure every kid graduates at the same level. You know, it may not be an opportunity to be using your privilege in that way to change something that big, but it may be the opportunity to say to a colleague, man, this kid is really smart in your class. I think maybe if you try allowing the kid to use spoken word in their homework, might allow them, allow you to make a different kind of connection.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. My guest today is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. He's Executive Director of the Privilege Institute, and he's also the founder and program director of the White Privilege Conference and was recently in La Crosse and Winona. You mentioned before we started the interview that when you think about elections and you think about politics, one of the big things you think about and that you really talk to people about is voter turnout. And how that's one of the biggest issues, obviously.
Yeah. I think, again, it feels like sometimes young people especially are feeling like this really doesn't matter. But also that it seems like that most of the people who are running for the offices are always in conflict, always in battle. It's like you're voting for the greatest gladiator. It's just not, I don't think, a real attractive option. So I think I have some concerns about that. But also we're seeing what feels like some barriers to voting being passed in some places where you now have to produce an ID, so to speak. And again, I don't know. I go back and forth about that because I can understand that you don't want people voting twice, all that kind of stuff. But I can see how that can be a shield to some people feeling comfortable coming out and all that. So those are the kind of concerns I have. Young people, especially around what's really this pick the best gladiator kind of. I mean, you watch the commercial. It's just like who can why would I go out and participating in this? And then also when I want to go out, it's like I got to have, you know, all these forms or whatever. It's like more of a hurdle for me to participate in the process than it is to just stay home and not have to deal with all of that.
We have another more year of President Obama's year as, or 8 years as first African-American president. You know, when you reflect on these 8 years, what do you think? Has anything changed for the African-American community? You know, whether it's maybe inspiring young men and women to get involved in politics or whether it's actually improved racial conversations anywhere. Right. I'm not sure. I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, that's a great question. I usually say this, that it's important for us to recognize the president's mom because he recognizes his mom. So we should say he's a biracial president.
Biracial president, right? Yep.
But we do know that, you know, that whole thing about when he gets pulled over, how he identifies, all that kind of stuff, which could be black man. So I think it's important just to mention that first. Mm-hmm. You know, I've loved these 7 years. I'm going to miss the president. And I think the one thing that the nation has missed out on, the greatest benefit of President Obama's tenures, is the visible presence of a black man in the White House, of a black family in the White House. That what that does for me psychologically is just medication. Sometimes I'll just watch the president on TV, won't even listen, and just like say to myself, damn, I'm in the White House. I just think psychologically the message that sends to my son now, where years and years of my life, I never thought that was even possible. And who knows whether it'll happen again, but I can never say to my son, we've never had a black man in the White House. This is not possible. And I can't walk into the streets of Chicago, St. Louis, and say to a group of black men, wherever they are, and say, bruh, you can be president someday. Right? I think we're missing that opportunity to really challenge young black males in that way, to say this is the excellence that you have the potential to be. And so that's what I'm going to miss most for me, is seeing myself walk out on the lawn, get on that helicopter, get in Air Force One, address the United Nations, right? Speak the State of the Union address, right? Like on the talk show circuit, man, it just felt so good to see me in that position psychologically. And I hope in this last year, in addition to some of the things that he has to do that's related to the work, that people not forget about the psychological impact and challenge our kids, support our kids more and more to understand this is who you are. This is what you have the potential to be.
Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. is executive director of the Privilege Institute and the founder of the White Privilege Conference, a national annual event that deals with issues like diversity and leadership. He was in the area this fall speaking with students at UW La Crosse and Winona State University. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.